but I needed to drive it around the race Bronco around because we needed wheels to get parts and all of that.
Right.
I was so shocked that in race trim, I had no windshield on it, just a little wind deflector with Foolish Pleasure on, written on it that I called it. The racing harnesses, all the everything else, window nets, we'll have to take them off so we could use it. And the three of us, my wife sitting in between myself and my brother-in-law on a pillow. And we drove it around. We went through the McDonald's drive-thru. We passed a couple of police officers. Never got pulled over.
Are you into four-wheeling, camping, and exploring? How about off-road racing like mud bogs, short course, wheel-to-wheel racing, or even desert races? Well, you've come to the right place. Welcome to 4x4 Canada Podcast. My name is Wes, and I've been four-wheeling since I was 6 weeks old. I have over 20 years' experience in 4x4 shops, many more than that in the off-road racing, and a lifetime of exploring the backcountry across Canada. Every week, we bring you a new guest where they give you their perspective on the industry. We discuss everything from four-wheeling, overlanding, every form of off-road racing across this great country, as well as we talk to Canadian manufacturers and 4x4 shops. Just a quick reminder that if you're looking for more episodes, you can find all of our episodes on 4x4CanadaPodcast.com or your favorite podcast sharing platform. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at 4x4CanadaPodcast.com. Now let's get to the show. Hey everybody, I'm your host Wes.
And I am Trisha. Nice to meet you, everyone.
And my name is Rory Brown. I'm the guest tonight, and I'm more than happy to be with the two.
It's awesome. I've really been looking forward to this, Rory. Welcome to the 4x4 Canada podcast. It's something that you and I have been going back and forth, and I've been really looking forward to this interview tonight. So before we get too deep, I just want to ask our listeners for a quick favor. If you enjoy the 4x4 Canada podcast and you get value from it, please share it with your friends or someone you think that will enjoy it as well. I also want to mention, those that know me are aware that I love history and the vintage stuff. If you're interested in this also, I recommend checking out two of my groups on Facebook. The Vintage Four-Wheel Drive Canada group is a place for people to talk about and share photos about four-wheeling years ago. It's also a great spot for owners of vintage 4x4s to share information and show off their rigs. And the Off-Road Race Canada history group is full of great photos and videos of all forms of off-road racing across Canada from before 2000. So two really good groups that I find quite entertaining. So tonight we're talking with Rory Brown from Vancouver Island. He was involved in the four-wheel drive scene from the 70s into the 90s. And off air, you mentioned that you kind of got hooked on four-wheeling when you were out hunting as a teenager.
Yeah, that's correct, Wes. My parents owned the campground at French Creek, which is a small boat harbor halfway in between Parkersville and Qualicum. They had owned the property for quite a while. Got to know some of the local fishermen, the commercial guys. One of them they became pretty good friends with. He was really into corn binders, international harvesters, and he owned a Scout 800, which is one of the very first ones that they came out with. Small little pickup truck, rode like a tank, little four-cylinder, not a lot of power. But he was also into hunting, and my dad was trying to get us interested in that aspect of outdoors and asked this gentleman to take us along on a few hunting trips that were locally around in the Parkersville, Qualicum area. And from that point, piqued my interest in four-wheel drives, because up until then, they were just riding little mini bikes around in the bush and stuff like that. But where that Scout could go certainly opened my eyes about how rough a road could be and still you could drive over it, right? So
yeah, exactly.
That was my start.
And then you also mentioned that your first off-road capable vehicle was actually not a 4x4, was it?
No, it wasn't. I kind of went behind my dad's back, and I paid for that for a little bit. There was a fiberglass Volkswagen dune buggy for sale close to where we lived in French Creek. And it was really cheap. And for the allowance that I had collected over the years, I had enough to go and buy it. But I wasn't brave enough to bring it home for right away. So the cool thing about it was it had a bus transaxle in it. And I don't know if you know, the buses of that, the Volkswagen buses, had a gear reduction on the end of the axles, much like the Unimogs. Unimogs, yep. And the particular owner who converted it did a really good job by laying the offset like horizontal rather than vertical. So the dune buggy actually drove really good and was pretty level, right? If you see something like a buggy or a VW with the bus transaxles and that hasn't been done, the back end really sticks up high. So brought it home, got kind of, here's my driver's license, Dad, you can keep it for a couple of months. But after that penalty was over, I used it for a couple of years driving around the logging areas close to where we lived. It was great to get out. The gearing was just neat enough to get down most of the Forest Service roads. It was by no means capable to go up something that had been washed out or anything, but I had a lot of fun driving it around. And when I sold it for a profit, Dad was pleased.
There you go.
They're actually not bad vehicles off-road, especially with that gearbox, the bus gearbox. Mm-hmm. They're actually, you know, kind of capable just because they're so light, right? Yep. And you got the, you know, did you have the turning brakes in it?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No, I didn't. There was a few people that used to come to our campground, and a couple of them had tube chassis buggies, right? With that kind of arrangement on them, and had a couple of rides. One of them had a 2180cc diversion, like a big bore kit in it, and it flew.
Yeah, they move pretty good. So, yeah. So let's get into the 4x4s. You were a Bronco man, and
primarily because I had been around short wheelbase vehicles for four-wheel drives. I told my friends had Jeeps and Land Cruisers and had gone off with them off-road. But being a Ford guy, the only alternative to that was a Bronco, right? So, yeah, my first purchase was an early Bronco, six-cylinder, three on the tree, 170 cubic inches of not a lot of power. And it came with a soft top and a roll bar along with the hard top. And I had a lot of fun with it. I bought it primarily for skiing because at that time I was into skiing big time and I was getting tired of putting chains on. All these guys would get out, turn the hubs and go, well, I'm under in the mud, put the chains on. So that was the primary reason that I bought it. Unfortunately, I only owned it for a couple of years because a couple of winters later, I hit some black ice and flipped it on its roof, which is pretty common with the early Broncos because of the coil springs. They get a little sideways, that coil spring sinks so fast, it just kind of flips it onto the roof. There was no sign of a rollover on the other side, but the roof and the front of the hood was mashed pretty good. I had some really cheap ski carriers, thankfully, and it was so violent on the rollover that it threw the skis off the truck, and they just got banged up a little bit. They could have been in pieces if they had been stuck on the roofs. That was the end of that one, but it got me into the four-wheeling with the sidewinders, because come summertime, I wanted to do more with it. Some of my friends had four-wheel, and a person I knew in high school, Randy Jenkins, was a member of the sidewinders, and from that, he got me into the club.
Yeah, Randy Jenkins, that name's ringing a bell. I think I've seen it bouncing around a few times over the years. So the Nanaimo Sidewinders Club. Now, from my understanding, that started in 75, and they became a member of the Four Wheel Drive Association in 76, 77, when the association formed. Now, back then, the clubs were very typical, a lot of monthly club runs and very family-orientated from what I do remember as a kid. They also did some racing and stuff like that. So after you rolled that Bronco, that was back, what, 78, 79?
Something around there, yeah.
So you rolled the Bronco. What did you get into next?
Let's see. I'll have to check my notes here.
Not a problem. I think that was your 69 F-250.
Oh, yes. I bought it because it was for sale locally. It was a company truck. An HVAC company had used it. It was right in my price range, meaning it was cheap. So it was my first foray into something that was long wheelbase. It was bone stock, standard, everything. No power brakes, no power steering, closed knuckle front end. So it had the seals. Got really good at replacing them because they would not last very long. It was a high boy, had the remote transfer case. And I actually four-wheeled it a lot with the club. Entered a couple of Van Isle 200s with it. My wife Jean was pregnant on one of those trips, and she survived the whole thing. I got quite a few, threw a few winch, all of the winch points that were off. Surprised the heck out of the guys that were manning it. Oh, that's never going to get up here. Oh yeah, just watch me. Yeah. And then I bought a camper to go along with that. I was in the trades and needed a place to stay when I was down in Victoria taking my year apprenticeship training for electrical. So both of them fit well with what I was doing at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you also mentioned earlier off air that in 1980, you picked up another Bronco that you used for racing. Let's talk about that Bronco. And then I want to get into the racing back then, which is quite different than, well, what there is now.
Sure. So there was a few members in our club that raced. It was actually Randy Jenkins again that gave me the bug for that. And this is maybe where you remember, I sent a picture to one of your websites, racing website, of his Ram Charger. He was into Dodges at the time. He had this Ram Charger with a big block in it. He and I are sitting on the line and Rick Rayner is sitting, leaning on the truck at the waiting for it to go in the pit at the race in Campbell River.
Yep.
So that one lap with that pretty much put the bug into, hey, I really want to try this, and realize that, first of all, an F-250 is not really good to go. And secondly, you don't really want to beat the crap out of the truck that you want to drive on the street, because you don't want to be picked trying to fix it on Sunday night so you can get to work on Monday morning. So there was another member, and I talked to him and kind of made an arrangement that if I found something, possibly would he go together with us and buy it, and we'd race it together. Much like a few members did in the club.
Yeah.
I was going to trade school again and drove by this 69 that was parked in the front yard under a cedar tree. It had been there for a long time. I could tell it was just, you know, it had the green gunge on her and stacks of old cedar boughs sitting like piled all over it. Drove past it two or three times that particular year down there, the 2 months I was down there, finally stopped and said, hey, do you want to sell it? And my timing was perfect because he had just been contemplating about doing that exact thing.
Nice.
He said, yeah, sure. You can have it for $1,200. And I said, okay, perfect. I got a partner. I'm going to go check to see if that's what he wants to do. He unfortunately said, no, I can't afford to do it right now. But I was really hooked, so I had to have it. Scraped the $1,200 up, went down and to pick it up. And he said, oh, yeah, it comes with a few spare parts. Boy, did it ever. Had a spare body from the firewall back, a couple of spare doors, brand new gear set for the Dana 30 front end. The truck was complete, although it was standard steering and Dana 30 front end and stuff. I shouldn't say standard steering, standard brakes, three on the tree, Dana 30 front end. It did have a power steering unit. And back then, one of the popular little fixes for non-power steering Broncos was taking the box out of an early T-Bird and Okay. Splicing it in on. It's a weird setup. It sits high off the frame, the box. It sits on the outside of the frame, so you have to have the steering column kind of do a shimmy to the left to get out to it. But it drove really nice, and it was way quicker than a box. So carted that all home and started work on it right away. Sold a lot of parts to help finance the thing. It was a problem getting on the trailer. It wouldn't go in neutral. I had to put the transfer case in neutral. So I'll push it up on the truck. Of course, I hadn't run for years. Got it running in the two-wheel drive or within the transfer case in neutral, and realized that the clutch disc had frozen to the plate. So rather than take it apart, I backyard fixed it. Shade tree fixed it. Got the 289 running, jacked it up in the back end of the truck, up, put the transfer case in two-wheel drive, had my brother sit in it, and I kicked it off of the jack stand. First time it stalled. Second time we did it, he revved it up and pushed it off, and it let go with a pretty good bang, but it was free. It chattered for a while, but after driving on the road for a while and getting it broke back into functioning fine, I never had a problem with it racing or anything like that. So it had a lot of fun. My brother helped build a roll cage for it. He's a heavy-duty mechanical welder. I found a couple of seats from a Mustang high back. Had an upholsterer friend of mine modify them with the hole through the back for the harnesses. And he did a tunnel cover for the back of it on the roof. And I bought some Desert Dogs and scabbed enough rims together to put the Desert Dogs on there. And in the end, I had probably $1,500 into it after making the money back on the parts. And I had a lot of fun racing. for 2 years before it finally blew the front end up.
So let's go back to the Desert Dogs. Desert Dogs were the tire back
they in were.
The late 70s, early 80s. They were the tire. And were yours the X style?
Nope, just the standard.
Or the Wave?
Yeah, the standard Wave. Nice soft tire, worked great in the dirt. You didn't dare drive them more than about 5 miles on pavement because they would wear out faster than you would know. Except I did end up driving on the pavement with it because I had it licensed. We were going up to Kamloops for a race, and I was toying with the 69, the camper and all that. And coming into Penticton, I could hear a squeak. So I gone, okay, what is that? Finally figured out that the front bearing had died. So limped it into Penticton, went to a campground there, asked, hey, explained I had a problem with the front end. Would they mind if I did a repair? It was fairly early in the year, so they had no problem. But I needed to drive it around, the race Bronco around, because we needed wheels to get parts and all of that.
Right.
I was so shocked that in race trim, I had no windshield on it, just a little wind deflector with Foolish Pleasure written on it that I called it. The racing harnesses, all the everything else, window nets, we'll have to take them off so we could use it. And the three of us, my wife sitting in between myself and my brother-in-law on a pillow. And we drove it around. We went through the McDonald's drive-thru. We passed a couple of police officers. Never got pulled over. Of course, these days, that would never happen, right?
So yeah, totally. Yeah. The other tire back in that era was the Terra tires.
Yep. And I borrowed a couple of them off of either Greg and Craig or Rick and Bruce, and had them with us when we went to Kamloops, because I used them when I raced the obstacle and did the hill climb with it.
Yeah, that was a big combination. Desert Dogs in front and Terra tires in the back. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know what the Terra tires are, they're basically a wide, I think they're like a 31 by 15 and a half or something like that. 15 tire, and with basically a zigzag, you know, across.
Yep.
And they originally were used on some of the implements, weren't they?
They were a farm tire. They even said not DOT approved on it. I'm not sure if any police officer ever caught on to that, because there was a few people who would run them on the street, right? But again, they didn't want to do it too long because they'd wear out really, really fast.
Exactly. Yeah. And like I say, that was the combination. You know, Desert Dogs 31 by 10 50 on the fronts, and 31 by 15 50 Terra tires on the back.
Yeah.
And with the racing back in the 70s and into the 80s, back then they're called basically play days, and it was a combination of different events. You had the sand drags, which you're racing against somebody else. The hill climb, which you're racing by yourself up a steep hill, and whoever got the best time up would win. The obstacle course, usually one vehicle at a time around a rough course. For our listeners, can you explain what the team relay was?
So a team relay progressed from obstacle racing. It was probably a precursor to wheel-to-wheel, like what you see today. Yeah. And wheel-to-wheel was just starting to occur back then, but it wasn't very popular because you're beating and bashing on your trucks and having to replace a lot of stuff usually after that. So a team relay was a set of four trucks. It was generally set up on the same obstacle course that you had competed singly on. They would put between two and four gates, sometimes three. It all depended on the layout, but at minimum two, maximum usually four. The teams could get together. They would, the start gate would be set to go towards the direction that everyone was going to go around. They would go bumper to bumper in line. There was a flagger on each gate. They were looking at generally a flagger in the middle of the course. When he raised his flag or she raised his flag, everybody raised the flag and the race was off. So the first vehicle would go and go around, and the line would move. And then the way the finish gate was, it's right in front of the next vehicle to go, so that there was no chance of jumping. The vehicle had to clear the start gate before the next truck or vehicle, SUV, whatever, could go. And everybody would do the rounds until the final truck came in. And then when it was finished, when that last vehicle cleared the finish gate, the flag starter would raise the flag that that team had finished. And there would be four people watching that guy with stopwatches, and that's how they would time the race. So, and generally it was a ladder was built, and they would take the, depending on how much racing you wanted to do, they would either take the one team from say four or five combinations or a couple teams. If there was only, you know, enough for maybe two races, and then they would race again, do the same thing over again. So it was actually,
so basically there's two to four vehicles on the track at all one time, but they're spread out enough that
they are,
that they're going around. So as you come off, say your first driver, you pull off and your guy that on your team would be hit the hammer, he'd be out. And then same thing until all four vehicles in on your team are done.
So, you still have to be careful, because sometimes maybe another vehicle from another team is having a little difficulty and hasn't quite got past your start gate. So you had to, it wasn't just watching your guy. You also had to make sure or be aware of the locations of all the trucks on the course at the time.
And what were you allowed to, like, obviously you want to race with your buddies on your team kind of idea.
Yep.
Did they have any rules, like you had to have a stock vehicle and then a modified vehicle, or you just run?
No, it just, you and your buddy? Just run whatever you could put in. In Kamloops, team got put together, and I was the only one from the Sidewinder, so I just put my name in a hat, and there was two four-wheel drives, I think my Bronco, a Jeep, and two buggies. So it didn't matter really of what type of vehicles. In the end, they all kind of balanced out, right? There was never any huge, like big horsepower didn't necessarily give you a big advantage, right? So,
yeah, especially on some of those tight courses, right? So, yeah.
Or the mud or whatever, the, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And then the barrel races, that was another fun event that you guys had. And it's the same idea that you see barrel racing with horses, but you're doing it with a Jeep or a Bronco or a buggy or whatever. But you just got to be careful, because there's those grooves. Every time you go around the barrels, the grooves are getting deeper. So there's a few rollovers, I remember.
That or clipping the barrel. Same, you go around them the same direction as the horse racers doing the horse racing and stuff. So it's not the only event that is based on agriculture that four-wheel drives would do. And we'll get into discussing some of the other events that was created just for fun, right? So
definitely that'll be the next. But out of these regular events that you'd see at pretty much every race, what was your favorite?
I had fun doing all of them. I raced all of them at one point or another. I'd have to say the team really was the most fun, but I'm a drag racer too, so I enjoyed drag racing. I like obstacles or racing, because it was still based kind of on the team relay. But the team relay was a team, right? So you could be pretty successful if you had a bit of an off lap. The rest of the team could pick it up and still you'd still move on to the next round, right? So
it definitely fun. And they still do the team relay over at the races in Port Alberni on the island. The Island Off-Road Racing Association, which, you know, I'll throw another plug into them. They have some great racing, or they got the wheel to wheel. They've got sand drags. They've got mud drags, and they have the obstacle course, but the team relay is still one of the key events over there. And it's just such a fun event, right?
Yeah. I raced in that pit a few times before it really got organized as the way it is now.
Yeah.
And stuff. I had a lot of fun there. I've got pictures of one of my daughters sleeping in my arms along the edge of the pit. Well, there's open headers running behind it. And I saw a Subaru Brat race the course there, which was very weird, because hardly any exhaust. And here's a stock vehicle whipping it around, and he was beating the heck out of it.
The Subaru Rat back in that era, that was a Subaru, like a car basically, but it was a little pickup. And it's just something you didn't see
Two little jump seats in the back, right? Facing backwards with little handles to hold on. I'm sure really legal and safe in a car accident.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't do much safety testing on that one.
No.
So some of the other events, there's a lot of fun events at these play days. And there is the blindfold obstacle, which is also known as the divorce race. And
get into that.
Yeah. The egg carry, the stone boat, the teeter-totter, The kids' obstacle. I really remember the kids' obstacle, and I've got lots of pictures with me and my dad, and be sitting on my dad's lap, and he'd operate the pedals and the shifter, and I would operate the steering wheel. So here I am, you know, 5 years old or 7 years old or 12 years old, and then eventually moving into where I can do the pedals by myself and stuff like that. And you get these little tiny trophies, and it was just, that totally made the weekend for us kids, right?
So yeah. I got pictures of Daryl and with his son Warren on his lap at a race in Mount Nair in Nanaimo here.
So, yeah, that was just, you know, and that goes back to the whole event being a
family
event, right? Yeah. I mean, there was some, you know, from some of the stories I've heard, there's some pretty good drinking on a Saturday night, but
complete rumors. No pictures, no cameras.
Yeah, we didn't have the cameras back. Yeah. You didn't have the cell phones back then, right?
Yeah. So,
but yeah, it was, you know, really a family event back then. So maybe if you can explain to our listeners, and Tricia, I think some of these ideas would be really neat for the events that you do with your GTA Jeep Girls and other events that you guys do out there. Like the blindfold driver is it's called the divorce race. And so basically the driver is blindfolded, as you can imagine, and the passenger is giving them directions.
Oh my goodness.
I've done these before in the past, and I've found that you got to go my way, your way. That's the way you got to communicate, instead of this way and that way. And you're trying, you're pointing. Obviously the person can't see you, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of that. And then there's, as you said, sometimes the interaction between the driver and the navigator was, shall we say, involved colorful language and could get testy at times.
Yeah. I know a few couples that will not do it together. They'll have like a, you know, their friend do it with them or something like that, because
just safer.
Yeah, exactly. But
so it was done generally on a flat surface. It wasn't, they call it obstacle, but it was usually a flat surface with cones. And it would be as simple as a slalom that you would go up and then come back, or it may involve sharper turns where you had to drive into like a parking area, like coned off parking front way. And then you might have to back into another one somewhere else on the course, and then again, drive back to the finish line.
Totally picturing something totally different. I'm thinking, okay, or what hills are they going up? Like, how are
No.
Wow, that is a challenge. Okay.
Yeah, a little bit of a safety hazard there, because if somebody got a little over rambunctious on the gas pedal and you're going off a hill with a drop off, you can easily, you know, fly it off. So most of these fun events are always held on the flats, just to make a waste safer. And it's not for to see how good you could get your vehicle over something. It was to how good you could interact with either another driver or another vehicle. So a real popular one was a stone boat. And a stone boat comes from agriculture. It's a farm-based deal. It's a sledge built out of either timbers, sometimes just tree trunks lashed together. It would be hooked up to a horse or an oxen or pairs of horse and oxen. And they would load onto this sledge stones, rocks, or hay bales and drag them off the field or off to the edge so that they could get their plows up on it. So in the case of four-wheel drives, they would build a sledge. I think the one in Kamloops that they used was, again, using just tree trunks, all lashed together and nailed together. On it would be placed generally a smaller, lighter four-wheel drive, flat fender, four-cylinder, nothing really modified, just something kind of light, because the idea wasn't like a tractor pull where you're actually trying to stop stuff. It didn't move like the weight on a tractor pull sled. It was stationary. Sometimes they would tie them down, but generally, it wasn't violent enough that the vehicle couldn't just be in four-wheel drive low and with motor shut off, right? Mm-hmm. And so you would back your truck in or your vehicle in, and then you hook it up and you'd see if you could move it. If you couldn't move it, then you're disqualified. If you could move it, it became a timed thing on how far you could pull it, a distance first, how far, and then they would set a distance that you're trying to pull to. So it would be timed first distance, and then if you made a full pull, for a better explanation, you would be timed. I remember one time it was generally held on soft ground. So like the strip or soft ground like that. I remember at Kamloops watching the Stone Boat. And, there was a guy with a short box, 3/4 ton that he had probably built, 390 automatic. He could move it at will. He was the winner. So people would try to pull, dig a little hole. He'd hook up, drag it a little farther down the track. I never competed in it because I just didn't have anything that I thought had enough grunt to actually do it. Yeah. There was, at that particular race, a guy came out with a really hot Jeep, big block in it or whatever, built for drag racing, had paddle tires on and everything, hooked up, revved the crap out, and everybody's running, no, dropped the clutch and just went poof into the ground.
Just dug right down, eh?
Just dug right down.
Yeah, the egg carry is another really interesting one that anybody can do, right? You can do it in a field or whatever. And you want to explain that one for us?
Sure. So it involves two vehicles, 4 competitors, a driver, a navigator, or a person in the passenger seat, and 2 plungers, preferably clean, like toilet plungers, and an egg. That isn't hard boiled. It's an egg that could, if it's dropped or squeezed too hard, it's going to break. So you set up another slalom course, generally something where they have to turn the vehicles. You line the vehicles up, passenger side to passenger side. The plungers are put out. The egg is put in the middle, and then it's go. So it goes in one direction. So one vehicle's going in forward. The other one vehicle's going in reverse, and they're trying to turn around these cones. When they get to the end of that, they reverse. So the vehicle that was going forward now has to back up, and the one that was going in reverse gets to go forward. And so it was, again, a timed event. You drop the egg, you DNF'd, or if you squeeze too hard and it broke the egg inside the plungers, again, it was a DNF. So it was interesting to me. A couple of key points to doing that is that you want to use vehicles with kind of the same wheelbase. And it's better if the vehicles don't have doors. I mean, they can still be done with doors and the windows rolled down. It's just a little easier to lean out a little farther if you have to in a Jeep or a Bronco or whatever. Of course, you're wearing seatbelts, so you can only go so far. Mm-hmm. But it's another little fun event that gets people laughing and pictures taken. And
why? You know,
These events are, you know, they're fun events like the blindfold and the egg carry, and they're fun events that I would love to see brought back. Just even if it's just a group of friends having a fun day and they got a field to go in. All the videos I've seen of them and all the pictures and my memories of them as a kid, they're such fun events that can be just a good laugh, right? So
yep.
I think it's great. Now, the other one that I remember my mom talking about was where you had to hold a bucket or a glass of water. The passenger did. And yes. You go around the driver and you would go around an obstacle course kind of idea.
And you have an actual course where there's jumps and raises and turns and bumps and all the rest of that sort of thing. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to have that glass of water. Now, so I've seen various versions of it. You know, some of them they have put it between your legs just as a joke because you definitely don't want to spill any then, right? And I've seen them where they've had to put it on the hood of a vehicle. But most times, I think it was the one person was holding it.
Oh, yeah.
And my mom has talked often about this once when they're in Calgary and they were going through the Bow River on the obstacle and doing this water glass or water bucket. I think at that one, it was a water bucket. And as you're going through the river and through the Bow River, and I guess dad forgot to put it in 4-wheel drive. So of course they get stuck. And so she just dumps it all water all over dad, right? Little did they know that the local TV station was there filming that. So they were on the highlight reel for that night with her dump all the water over his head. But that's another fun event. There's lots of different events like that I've seen pictures of giant beach balls, you know, kind of idea, right? And you got to push that through a little core, like through a chicane or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I've seen pictures of those in magazines. I haven't seen it up here, but there's lots of different fun events that people can do. And Trisha, I think something like that would be really neat to do with your GTA Jeep girls and some fun events. Another one was the teeter-totter.
Yeah, the teeter-totter takes a little bit to set up because you need fairly strong timbers to support the weight of whatever vehicle you might expect. So it could be up to a 3/4 ton because unless you limit, you have to limit it for what materials you're using. It's just like it sounds, like a teeter totter. It's these are put over a log, or even sometimes they build a special structure that will hold the timbers. They're in such a way that they can be moved for different widths of the vehicle. You start by getting the vehicle all four wheels on one side of the teeter totter. So the one end's touching the ground, the far side's up in the air. When everything's calm, the starter goes start. And then you have, it's a timed event with the object to get the beams either totally balanced, or sometimes they would have a time frame that where both the front and the back of the timbers weren't touching the ground. So you could creep up enough and it would start going forward enough. And if you had it just going slowly, as soon as the back end was off, they would share a stopwatch. And usually it was like 20 or 30 seconds, quite some time. So if you were, it was hard to control. It was hard to get them set, them level. And it was hard to control the totter or the teeter in such a way that you could beat the stopwatch. Again, lots of fun. Go up, it started going too fast, and they'd try to creep back, and they would fall. The back would retouch again, so that's your DNF. So another interesting and a skill. It looks easy, but it takes a lot of skill and nerve to be able to get those timbers level.
Yeah, so it's basically it's two ramps. It's not just you're not having to deal with one, but you're actually having to deal with two moving around. And when I was at National 4-Wheel Drive in Burlington years ago, we ended up building one for one of our open houses, and it was the most popular thing there. And it's like you say, it's a skill. It's a true skill to try, you're not even an inch, you're like a quarter inch at a time just to make that perfect balance. Right. So it definitely a fun event for sure.
Yep.
So you mentioned some of the sidewinders that raced some of the Nanaimo sidewinders, Greg Berg, Greg Fraser, Daryl Johnson, Rick and Bruce Morgan, and John Lees and Richard Rayner. I know Daryl Johnson still races with the Island Off-Road Racing Association in Puerto Bernie. He's got a few rigs actually.
Yeah. And he races south too. Some of the longer distance races. Although he hasn't had too much luck trying to get down there the last couple of times. He's had the tow vehicle issues, and I haven't talked to him since his last trip down, so I'm not sure how that went. But
He's usually got a few vehicles in the go, and he's done some distance racing down south for sure. And Greg Bird, I mean, Greg raced his early Bronco for years.
Yeah, and him and Fraser are they built that together. They were kind of nicknamed the Borneo brothers. It was a Cleveland, a 351 Cleveland in it. And the top loader 4-speed out of a car, it flew. And I saw it when it was initially built. And then the progression from just the racer for fun days to and play days to the awesome off-road racer or distance racer that it became, right?
And it's, I think Daryl has it now.
I believe Daryl does still has it somewhere on his property.
Yeah. From my understanding, it's just sitting there.
Yeah.
Pieces.
Bruce and Rick, they raced a Bronco too, an early Bronco. It had a 351 Windsor in it. Interesting little factoid about that is that the cage that they built started with the roll bar from my wrecked 73 because the wreck got bought by a local wrecker down south.
So what was John Lees and Richard Rayner racing?
So John had a early Land Cruiser. Soft top, full cage. I think he had it slightly modified 600 in it. I think gas ran header and a Weber carb because you couldn't get an aftermarket manifold, but you get a Weber carb to sit on instead of the single barrel. And in actual fact, John, Richard, Daryl, Greg were all the original signatories on the Sidewinder's constitution and bylaw. And where I live in Imo, the house next door was Richard's. So, and down the road going the other way was another original member. So they, Rick and Bruce would take theirs. They were one of the two teams that went and raced the Boomerang 250, which we'll be discussing later.
Yep.
The other thing about John's Land Cruiser is that it's basically the base for the Sidewinder's little logo.
Okay.
They came up with Sidewinders. All the wives hated the name because they were thinking of Snake. And what they did was they took a caricature of his Land Cruiser and put a key in the side of it. Sidewinder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's where the name and why it looks the way the logo looks the way it is, the little red truck with the gold key sticking out of the side of it.
I never even thought of that. That totally makes sense. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And then Rick had a 76 or 77 short box step side 150 that he lightly raced. He would go in team relays a little bit, but the course had to be fairly flat because it was his family transportation.
Right.
And he didn't really want to beat the heck out of it, right? But he did race it. He was in a couple of team relays when the club was here on the island racing team.
Yep. So on the island, you guys raced in, you know, Victoria, Duncan, Nanaimo, Parksville, Port Alberni, Campbell River.
Yep.
And then some of you guys went up to, as you mentioned earlier, Penticton and Kamloops.
Quesnel. I think they went to Quesnel, yep. Yeah, I only went to Kamloops a couple of times. The Quesnel trips and stuff were mostly before I was really in the club.
Yeah.
But I've seen pictures of them racing on the Penticton and racing at the track and racing up the hills around it and coming back down on the track.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of, and then Mission, I mean, everybody knows Mission Raceway for the drags or for the asphalt drags and the road course, but Mission back in the early days had some great racing down there. They had sand drags, they had wheel-to-wheel racing.
Yeah.
There was
barrel racing, went to a couple of association-hosted events there. Wheel-to-wheel, I raced in the wheel-to-wheel and the obstacle course and on strips. I got great photographs of some of the stuff racing down that track. It was a really fun place to go and race. And I'm a drag racer from way back, so it was cool just to be there, right? The history and all the rest of that sort of thing, right?
So, yeah, there's a couple of years they had some pretty big drag races, like some guys coming up from Oregon, California and that for the racing there up Mission. So it was a pretty big event for a few years.
Yeah, running like dual paddle tires on rails and there was some pretty wild stuff. It passes down that in the dirt.
Yeah, some pretty exotic stuff. And then Stokes Pit in Surrey. I mean, a lot of people, you know, don't even really know about that. But yeah, there was off-road racing in Surrey. And it eventually, you know, did get shut down. But I've heard a lot of great stories about Stokes Pit.
Yeah. Did you know that Roger Manson was a competition director in 1977 for the association?
I didn't know that. No, I didn't. I've been talking to Roger, but I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was a hell of a rig. Pardon my language, heck of a rig. I was working the hill climb somewhere, either here on the island or the Kamloops. And that was even before he had the blower. He had that home tunnel ramp thing with the big couple of fours on it. And he revved that thing to 10 grand and dropped the clutch. I couldn't believe the big monster tack. I couldn't believe he was revving it that high. And he just flew up that hill like it was nothing.
And so just for our listeners that don't read, you know, don't or haven't heard about Roger Manson, he drove this beautiful little Willys Jeep and had a four-cylinder Pontiac engine in it. And it's basically half of a 389, I think. I can't remember off the top of my head.
That's the dimension, Jeff.
Yeah, yeah. So a little four-cylinder engine. And as Rory's mentioned, it kind of progressed through the years and started off stock and then a few modifications and then up into the dual four barrels on it. And then a supercharger on this little four-cylinder engine, and then alcohol as well. And we're talking early 80s, right? So this is all really high tech for that time period. And he would go over to Gravelrama over in Ohio, which is probably one of the biggest sand drag and hill climb events in North America. And he'd win over there.
And what made that so special was that the hill was that pea gravel, which was super hard to get traction in, right? So.
Yeah,
it was pretty impressive. If you could get your truck over the top of that, you were somebody.
Yeah, because it's shifting all the time. That peat, that gravel is just shifting, and it's really hard to get traction momentum. So, but yeah, Roger had a great, that little thing just flew. And it's so, from my, I don't really remember it much, but what I do remember is people talking about the sound of that four-cylinder screaming at 10,000 RPM and dropping.
Yeah.
And there's some other, you know, in regards to sand drags, there's some really neat sand drag rigs over the year. Vic Epp with his Bronco. You know, fiberglass red Bronco and the Green Machine, which was started off as a Ram Charger. And I do want to get Bob on the show as well, but he ended up building an aluminum body or stainless body with it and 440 with twin turbos.
Yeah.
And again, we're going back in the late 70s, early 80s, right? And twin turbos back in the early 80s was just, nobody had heard of that kind of like technology. Yeah. And it was quite interesting to look at some of the old vehicles and that. So I know some of the, you mentioned the Boomerang 250 over on the island, which was around Parksville, I think, right?
Yes, it started in the Northwest Bay division of Mackinac Blow. And there was a couple of pits very close to the gate. And it was about a 32 to 35 mile loop that went out over kind of the hills or low mountains over to the other side. Took maybe a 300-yard run down the paved Nanaimo Lakes Road that was up close to where the first lake is, and then it would make a comeback on the other side and come down the other thing and make a turn at the bottom of the V and race back up. And I think it was like 7 laps or something around that.
Yeah.
It was pretty tough.
Yeah. And it's a couple of years. You know, I do a lot of collecting newspaper articles and other artifacts to help me learn about the history of off-road racing in Canada. And one of the years I saw that there's just a ton of rain one year and it just looked like a mud show. Trisha would have loved it.
Favorite.
that was the second year. Our club didn't really participate in it. We were in the first year. It was overcast. There was a bit of rain on the backside of the course a little bit, but it was more or less dry. Mm-hmm. There was enough moisture to keep the dust down, which was a good thing. But
all vehicles on at the same time, right? So it can get dusty in some of these longer races. Now, let's talk about Roy Haslam.
Roy, he was an amazing racer, huge history in stock cars here on the island, and he did an amazing thing with the Suzuki.
A little Suzuki Samurai. It's actually the earlier version, but basically the same size as a Suzuki Samurai, and it appeared stock other than this great big wing on top of it. Like, we're talking a huge wing. Things massive, right?
Yeah.
And what does he do? There's all these other guys. You know, there's Bob Nesty with his high dollar V8 rig that he's racing down in the Mint 400. And there's some of the other guys like Greg Bird and Daryl Johnson and Tommy Moore come down from Quinnell and that. So there's some guys running some very, very capable rigs. And what happens is 2 years in a row, Roy Haslam wins overall in a stock Suzuki.
That first year, there was a bunch of guys that came up from California with a brand new, middle 80s, purposely built off-road racer. A guy down in California had built two of these and decided that he wanted to change class from that to Class 8 two-wheel drive pickups. So both of those machines were $250,000 each to get them built. They bought it for $100,000, which is still a smoking deal, but a lot of money.
Yeah.
They drove up. These guys had nothing but money. They drove up, stopped in Vancouver, bought a complete mechanics set because they had no tools. So like rolling cabinets and everything, either Snap-on or Craftsman or whatever, showed up brand new stuff. And it was very impressive. It was lapping the field. It looked like it was going to win until I think lap 4 or 5, they came in to do their pit stop, turned it off to do all of the, fluid checks and everything like that, went to go start it. The starter didn't work. And it's kind of some aftermarket special kind of started to go with the Art Man transmission and all the rest of that stuff. So nobody in the pits had anything that would work. So that was it. The race was done. Greg they didn't finish. They knocked off a drain plug at the bottom of the rear end. They had put up a drain plug in it, but it didn't cleanly break it off. The magnet was still stuck in there. So they couldn't weld it. The magnet was messing up the weld. The leaking 90 weight out of it couldn't be sealed with any sealer or anything. So they were done. I think Rick and Bruce finished, but they were way behind because on one lap, they had two flats, only one spare. So they finished over half of it on just a rim. Like they blew the desert dog off, and then the rim, things I got pictures of, is just kind of, they had to almost be beat off of the axle because it had been folded over so much. They had one more spare in the pits, but they needed another one to go with them. So I had my Bronco there, so I jacked it up and cautiously gave them one of my desert dogs. Thankfully, they didn't have to use it, so I got it back rather unscathed. But I was really worried that it was going to come, the rim was going to come back looking like that. The first one that they brought back.
So. Yeah, that's one of the things, you know, about racing some of these longer races is you got to finish to win. And anything can happen, right?
Yep. And classic tortoise versus a bunch of hares, right? Roy was just out there plodding along, doing his 35 miles an hour or whatever he was doing the course with, and just outlasted everybody's breakage.
And there's so many stupid things that can go wrong on a race like that. You can have a fuse blow, or there's been so many stupid things I've come across that can take you out of a race. And it's just like a 25-cent part, right?
Yeah. That occurs, Wes, in all sorts of racing. My brother works on blown alcohol stuff and both funny cars. And now he works on a AA altered out of Florida. And just the dumbest thing can kill a run. Right?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
Exactly. Racing luck, right?
Yep, exactly. And then even animals, you got to worry about animals out there, right? And cows and birds and...
some of the stories that Greg came back with running down in the Mint and that sort of thing, you would say you'd be roaring along, you'd pre-run the course, you'd be roaring along, and then all of a sudden there's a big pile of people standing somewhere. And he says, you knew exactly right then, you better get on the brakes because these idiots have... dug a jump.
It's a common thing down there. It is.
Yeah.
So, just so they can see somebody get big air and or crash.
Yeah.
For sure. So let's bounce back to your vehicle. You had your race Bronco, and then you picked up another F-250 in 1982. But let's talk about that parts Bronco that you bought in 1983. There's a story behind that one.
Oh, there is. I had was going to Calgary out to visit my brother, Sean, and on the way out, I was searching for a Dana 44 for a Bronco with the plans of getting my Bronco back racing. Couldn't find any wrecking yard on the way out. Got out to Calgary, spent some time, and in their buy, sell, and trade, or whatever their local parts deal, there was a 1977 wreck that said it was rebuildable. So I gave him a call and arranged to go have a look at it. And it had been hit pretty hard in the left front corner, I think, or one of the corner. I think it had to be the left front corner. But it was so hard that it actually pushed the front of the frame over so far, it split both frame rails from in front of the firewall forward. So, you know, I showed him that. I said, you know, the frame is unrepairable. So at the very minimum, you got to try and find a frame. And, you know, they're like hen's teeth trying to find one that hasn't been wrecked, you know, enough that frame isn't damaged. So I said, would you be interested in selling parts? You know, I was thinking, oh, maybe I can get the front end out of it, possibly the engine and all of that. He said, well, let me think about that. Again, another great timing on my part. They were expecting their first child. I guess they were a little short of money. So he phoned me up and said, hey, would you give me $1,000 for the whole thing? Okay. So I went and got a tow truck and got it towed over to my brother's place in Calgary. And the original plan was that I was just going to, you know, take the motor and the front end, possibly steering box, but I suspected that it was probably damaged. And then I was just going to get my brother to cart it away to the crusher. After I'd cut the front sheet metal off and pulled the motor out of it, I had this kind of little, well, I'll admit it, brilliant idea of possibly getting a hitch welded onto the front of it, take the front suspension out of it, and drag the whole thing back as a trailer. And my brother came home from work, and I dragged him out there, and I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Huh, I think it probably worked." He knew a couple of guys that were in the truck building and trailer building business, and he got one of them to come over and have a look, and we discussed it, and he said, "Yeah, no problem. You get the rest of this stuff off the front end and stuff, and I can make this work. No problem at all." So sure enough, stripped it right down, so it was just the frame back to the rear end, from the firewall back to the, you know, with the cab or top and everything still on it. He came over, he was a professional, put the, tacked the hitch where he thought it was going to go, measured from the hitch point to both sides of the rear end, got it perfect, like within probably a quarter of an inch of being the proper triangle, welded it all up. It was right at the proper level as it would fit on the tow ball on the top of my step hitch, rear step bumper. So it was perfect. I wired up the tail lights, you know, cut into the, being an electrician with no problem all of that out, and loaded the transmission and motor into the, and transfer case in the back of my pickup. I think I put the rear end in the back of the Bronco trailer now to kind of even the weight out, and headed for home. Almost lost it on the way home. I was getting into Banff, and there was some sheep or goats on the side of the road. BC boy, got to stop and take pictures. And as I'm pulling up to take pictures, I feel this distinctive clunking from the rear end. Huh, that's not very good. Get out, look. And the ball that I hooked to, I never thought about checking to see how tight it was. And it had almost fallen, the bolt had almost fallen out. So I limped into the parking lot for the train station and crawled underneath and tightened the bejesus out of it. And I never had a lick of problem on the way home. Never got bothered by, like, had a temporary permit on it and insurance. Never got bothered by any police. And I actually even stopped in Surrey on the way home for the four-wheel drive executive meeting. And there was a few comments like, "Who the hell owns that?" Yeah. So got it home and it sat in the backyard for a bit. And then plans changed. The family car we had decided was just... Well, it was to a point where it was unsafe to drive. So I took the race Bronco totally apart, left the front clip on it, welded the 77 back half of the body to it, adapted the doors from the early Bronco to the later model body, which is a lot harder than it looks because although they are identical, the point of where it attaches to the catch is in two different places. It's 3 inches off between years. So I had to reposition that, put the drivetrain in, painted it up, and it was our family vehicle for 10 years. Used it in Jasper. It was our family vehicle out there. Let me tell you how cold a steel roof Bronco gets when it's 40 below. I froze bananas behind the seat on the way home from Calgary one trip. And my kids were not happy, and we had them dressed in warm stuff, and they still weren't happy. So I ended up having to hang blankets around the back to keep the heat in. And after we did that, it was fine. But yeah, 40-degree weather just sucks the heat out of whatever you're pumping in there.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter what it is, right? So, and then, so you had that for quite a long time. And then back in, what, 93 or so, you picked up a full-size 78 Bronco. And that sounds like it was a pretty neat rig.
Yeah, I had to had another kid when I came back. So I was up to four. I'm a little tight to get a family of six into an early Bronco. And so what I call the club truck became available. So this full-size Bronco started off with Greg Fraser purchasing it brand new from Fogg Motors in the Lower Mainland. It was a part of a canceled fleet order. So he got a pretty good deal on it from what I understand. It was an XL, you know, no hardly any options in it. except four-wheel drive, right? The standard rubber floor mats and everything like that. So he bought it, started modifying it, came with a 351M in it, four-speed, granny low gear. Not sure if it had 410s in it, and probably not. They were probably 3.5s. But along the way, from that point, it progressed to a 4-inch lift kit getting installed. The 351 morphed into a 460 big block. Detroit rear locker, 410s in the back, by Detroit two-track in the front with 409s, because that's the different, or the gear set, but the 440 or the 44 meets up with the 410. And yeah, it was a pretty capable beast. It would go pretty much wherever I had pointed it. And it had been owned by somebody who had been in the club. Each time it was sold, somebody in the club would buy it. I think I was the fifth owner, and I think I bought it from Greg Bird. He had had it then. And I used it, four-wheeled the heck out of it, blew a Detroit up in it. The axle shattered right where it went into the rear differential, and split it apart. Never seen it, but from all the years of banging away on the axle, it fatigued the end of it. And that was the biggest, probably major repair I ever had to do with it. I used it for camping trips, four-wheeling, used it for pushing sprint cars at the local racetrack, Cassidy Speedway, and down in Victoria. It was a great truck. I owned it for almost 20 years. Wow. It was a great, great truck. So,
yeah, it sounds like a really neat rig.
Yeah.
And then you moved into your Dakota.
Yeah, the typical Ford. It was slowly rusting away to a pile of stuff, to a point where I didn't know if I was going to put my foot through the floorboards or whatever. So I put it up for sale, basically, just as parts. But an ex-club member, Jody High, he came over and had a look at it, somehow heard that I was trying to sell it. And I explained to him, hey, this is parts only. I'm not guaranteeing anything. I got another Bronco in the backyard with parts. You're not welcome to both of them, but man, they're parts only. His son's a welder. He says, hey, I can fix this. Okay, whatever. I gave a smoking deal on it. I just wanted to get all the stuff gone. At that time, there was a Dakota for sale in our neighborhood. Never really looked at it very, very closely because it was low. No indication that it was a four-wheel drive. And it was for sale for a long period of time. So I thought, well, there's nothing wrong with this or whatever. And it's probably two-wheel drive. My wife was delivering papers at the time, kind of a biweekly thing. She went by and talked to the people, and she said, hey, this is a four-wheel drive. You know, really? So I went and looked at it. Sure enough, four-wheel drive. But it was also a five-speed. So he was having a hard time selling it, because as soon as he would mention it was a standard, click, you know what they say, millennium any theft device, nobody can drive drive a standard anymore.
Nope.
So I went and took it for a drive. We had pretty low kilometers for the age. It'd been kind of maintained okay. And so I bought it for $3,000. Immediately took it to a local spring shop, got them to rebuild the rear springs with a 2-inch lift in it, cranked up the torsion springs a couple inches. So it's now a reasonable height, and put the 30 by 950 BFGs on it.
And it's great for what you're using for now, right? You know, for yep. back roads and the geocaching and stuff like that, right?
Exploring. And then it was our camping vehicle for a long time. We were still tenting back then. So we could load everything we needed in the back of that. And it went to Alberta a few times, and it was while we were driving when we were in Saskatchewan and got pissed on and stuff. So yeah, it's been a great vehicle. I still enjoy it. It hasn't through my career of owning vehicles. There's been very few years where I haven't had at least one. I might have had a hot car, but it still had a four-wheel drive.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I should have asked Tricia, do you have the questions in front of you? I got sort of used to not having another co-host. This is only our second time we've done the co-host thing. So.
Oh.
And the first person was somebody that she knew. So yeah. It was a good, you know, bounce back and forth. But I have to apologize, Tricia. That,
No. Don't apologize. Yeah. I'm here. It's just like I'm getting up all the history. This is awesome. No. No worries.
Okay. Okay. I wasn't sure there. So
well, I'm okay.
Okay. All right. So the Nanaimo Sidewinders, you mentioned off air that, you know, by the late 80s, they only a few guys are still racing that, and the club, you know, returned to his day runs and campouts and family stuff. We mentioned that the Nanaimo Sidewinders were involved in the Four-Wheel Drive Association, you know, since 77 up into the late 90s. And you also mentioned a lot of the club members held various positions in the association. There's, you know, Region 1 VP and Education Chairman, Vice President, etc. So the Nanaimo Sidewinders were very involved in the Four-Wheel Drive Association of BC over the years.
Yeah, we actually even hosted a convention one year in Nanaimo. There was really only two or three of us that really carried the mantle or the torch for the club at the association level. We truly believe in their what they're trying to accomplish and you know, use the outdoors in a shared basis. And we don't want access to everything, but we sure would like a little piece of the pie to share with other outdoor users. So a lot of club came and went pretty fast. I think in 1980, 82, there was maybe 51 clubs in the association, like 14 clubs here on the island. And it went up and down over the years too, and slowly as either clubs lost interest or the racing started dying off, especially in the late 80s when money became such an issue. A lot of rigs just either got sold, parted out, trashed, crushed, or whatever. So although we had a strong racing basis, we truly believed in the ideal of getting outdoors, exploring roads, and sharing the space with other user groups. So in that time, I think Greg was the first one to really step into a position on the executive of the association. He held the Region 1 Vice President, which Region 1 being Vancouver Island. Region 2, I think, was Lower Mainland. 3 was getting up into Kamloops area.
Yep.
There was up at one point up to 7 regions. I can't remember all of the locations. I sat as the education chairman from 82 to about 85 when because of employment and the dead construction era of the time, I had to go into the ski industry to make a living, and I got a job at Marmot Basin in Jasper. So I left the province for about 2.5 years. The club still moved along. I think there's a possibility that Greg was a vice president of the association during that time period, but I can't 100% say for certain that it was. When I came back, immediately joined the club again, got right back into representing our club at the Four-Wheel Drive Association level. I held the vice president for Region 1 for 5-6 years, wrote articles and columns for the Backroader, drew a couple of funny little cartoons for the Backroader. Yeah, I truly believe in what they stand for.
So the Backroader, for those listeners that don't know what that is, it's actually a magazine, I mean, that the Four-Wheel Drive Association BC puts out. And back in those days, it was a smaller, you know, one I've seen lots from the 80s and that. But it has morphed into a beautiful, high-quality magazine. I don't know if you've seen the ones that come out in the last, you know, 5-10 years. And they've been absolutely, you know, the pictures and the articles have been wonderful. But it's all based on volunteers like yourself writing those articles, right? So that's why it only comes out like once a year or once every 2 years right now, because it is all volunteer based. So, kudos to you for, you know, supporting that.
Even back then it was a problem producing it. It was printed. The idea was to print it 4 times a year. And it was just, it was like pulling hen's teeth to try and get anybody to contribute anything, right? It drove, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he was in Landscaper. He was the editor for quite a while.
John,
it just, John
something, I remember.
Yep. It would drive him nuts trying to get enough stuff together to produce something. So, and an organization like a club or a four-wheel drive association is only as good as the volunteers that want to put the work into it, right? It's really easy to sit at the back of the house and chuck, you know what, and not do anything, right? It takes dedication and a will to step up and put your two cents in or pull the rope, as it were, to move the organization forward, right? So
yeah, definitely. And it's really made some big gains. You know, for a while it was, the numbers were low in that, but I think as social media came on board, it really helped the association gain interest from other people and gain exposure. Really growing in the last, you know, 5-10 years. It's just really growing. Yeah. And so now we're starting to see a lot more, you know, a lot more interest and a lot more work being done around the province, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like there's work being there. We have rec sites up in the north, and there's talk about them opening up some new or other rec sites on the island and the fire lookouts and all that. So, but it's all volunteers, right?
Yep.
So speaking of volunteers, you represented the Four Wheel Drive Association on the island for a few land use planning inquiries. One of them was the Nahmint Valley Watershed. Yep. What was that all about?
So it's the Nahmint.
Nahmint. Okay.
Yeah. And the area has been prominent recently on the news. You've seen pictures of that drone footage of the of that big avalanche that came rolling down the mountain.
Yes.
That's the Nahmint Mountain. It's up a little side channel kind of the Alberta Inlet. As you head out to the west coast, about halfway down that valley in there. Initially, it was just a small little land use inquiry input wanted put out by the Port Alberni Forest District Office. So some small meetings, the association asked me to attend. I made a couple of presentations just saying we don't want any special access. We don't want you to cut down and make huge roads for us. But we ask that in consideration, when you do have roads, don't just automatically, you know, block them off again. Consider multiple uses other than just hiking in the stuff that's left behind. So it was pretty quick and easy, and I made an impression with the office there. They thanked me for giving them the pamphlets and the stuff that I presented to them.
Yeah, the input, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other one, I guess we should almost maybe mention before we get into the other one that for those that don't know, Vancouver Island is a lot of the southern island is owned by private companies. And so there's not a lot of crown land really left on the south of Vancouver Island. And when you think about it, Vancouver Island is actually quite a big area. You know, it's a very, very big island. And for the bottom half to be no crown land there's a lot of gates. So unfortunately, that's something that you guys are dealing with over in the island. The second thing that you're involved with was the Commission on Resource and Environment from 92 to 94. What was your involvement in that? And what was it about?
So that was a lot. That was a big, actually, job, a lot of meetings and that sort of thing. It was the idea of the government at the time to try and get all of the interested user groups, be it industrial, recreational, general public, and come up with a plan to designate how the island would be protected or used in industrial purposes and all the rest of that sort of thing. Very political. It was around the time that the Carmana was, which is for those that don't know, Carmana Valley is an old growth part of the island that was under pressure to be logged. And the commonly referred to as WC Square, the Western Committee, the Wilderness, whatever, they fought really hard to stop the logging. They went about it in a bit of a sneaky manner on expanding their base they were starting to take tours of bus tours out to show the Kamehameha and show what could be lost. I have no problem with that. What they were doing, though, is when you paid your $15 for the bus ride, you became a member, whether you knew it or not. So they went from 3,000 members to 30,000 members more or less overnight. And they sure knew how to make use the media. So they approached me, the association approached me again to attend this. I ended up in the recreational sector, which is where, you know, our interests are. I was the only mechanized user group in this sector. Couldn't get the mountain bikers interested in attending, couldn't get the snowmobilers interested in attending. So here I am sitting in the sector with hikers, biologists, you know, plant people, kayakers, sea kayakers. I was not, shall we say, welcomed in the group. So not only was I trying to, you know, put input into this whole thing, I was having to have interesting discussions with people of my own user group, which sometimes caused some rather nasty sectorial meeting because they had no use for anybody. They looked down at somebody who wants to mechanically use the outdoors as the big bad boogeyman. And they take that as far as mountain bikers or any other user group that uses something that has anything other than your 2 feet to move you. So it took a lot of input and pushing from my side to at least even get some acknowledgement that we had a right to be out there too.
Yeah.
It went on for 2 years, lots of input. Some of the board meetings, the roundtable meetings were unbelievably rough, and the WC squared were really good at quickly grabbing the reporters when there was something said that they could get a gotcha on from a user group or whatever.
Yeah,
it was definitely an interesting experience to see how the politics of the environment work. I suspect that they may be a little bit better now, but they're not far from what I witnessed during those 2 years. After all of that work, lots of production of pamphlets and big books and everything like that, nothing was really accomplished. It just kind of slowly petered off into the sunset, as it were. The getting back to the land use here on the southern part of the island, the history there is that it's called the ENN land grant because it was given to the big coal baron at the time. Part of the constitution, or the, not constitution, but the origins of Canada were that they were going to build a railway from St. John's all the way to Victoria. So, and to get membership of BC, they guaranteed that they would get a railroad built on Vancouver Island. A couple of place companies tried to do it. They went belly up. The government approached the big coal baron here, and they just started throwing land at him until he finally said, okay, I'll build it. They were willing, from what I read, to give him the whole island, but thankfully, he only took a third of it.
And this is going back into the late 1800s, kind of.
Oh, thing, yeah, right? The beginning of Canada, right? Yeah. So it was a decision made politically because from where they stood, the politics that they were trying to create a country.
Yeah.
They couldn't foresee the difficulties that it would cause. And even today, the land is starting to turn from forest land to they're selling it to produce housing and stuff on it. So they got this land for basically a dime per acre, and these companies are going to benefit from selling it off. It's an unfortunate thing about, you know, living in a country, right? There's decisions will be made that will not sit well into the future. And it's, you can't look into a crystal ball far enough ahead to see what a decision could or could not.
Yeah, especially when you're talking, you know, 100 years in the future or 50 years in the future, they're not seeing that, right? So, yep. And even today, with things that are happening today, it's going to affect things that are, you know, 100 years in the future for sure.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah,
definitely. Even the things that I've seen change on the island in my lifetime, right? And probably in the places that you've been in, you can see things that make you go,
Yeah, definitely. So, the last question that we ask our guests is, what Canadian would you like to listen to in a 4x4 Canada podcast?
Honestly, I have given this a lot of thought, and I can't really come up with. I'd like to hear Daryl and his son on their long distance racing, but I'm not sure if Daryl has the makeup to do that. He's kind of a quiet guy.
Yeah,
definitely. I'm really looking forward to Roger Manson.
Yes.
Him and I have had some really good conversations on the phone, and I think that's going to be a really neat one. And we can talk about his four-cylinder wheelies and his, you know, Bonneville Sap Salt Flat days.
Right? Yeah, and drag racing. He took that motor and put it in the same vehicle that he flat raced in and took it to Mission. He was pretty fast on the asphalt too. So.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, Rory, I think we're going to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you coming on board. And Tricia, I know you're 3 hours behind or 3 hours ahead of us, so it's late over where you are. So really appreciate you sticking around with us tonight. And I know I asked most of the questions tonight, but I know you've got some really neat guests coming on board in the future in the next, you know, 2-3 weeks. We've got some really interesting people coming out of Ontario, and I'm really looking forward to some of your interviews with these folks. So thank you, Tricia, for staying up late tonight. And Rory, that was a incredible conversation. That was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed that. And you know, it brought back some memories for me, and people are really going to be interested in what you had to say, everything from the racing to the Broncos to the association stuff. And I think there's a lot of people that are really going to be interested in that. So I love history. I love, you know, whether it's, you know, your history or my history or Trisha's history or anybody's history. I love learning about people and their lives and what they've done. And I really want to thank you for coming on tonight. And I just want to say I had absolutely loved it.
And I want to take the opportunity to thank both of you for having me. Like you, Wes, this has opened up a lot of memories. It made me dig through a lot of pictures that I haven't really taken time to look at for a while. Trish, I'm sure he's going to allow you someday.
I kind of overran the conversation tonight. Sorry about that.
I think coming, like, just being, I think, more like millennial, more newer in the off-roading, and just like hearing all your history and just the history of just off-roading in general. It's just like I'm in awe, and just, yeah, I just learned a lot, and I really, really enjoyed it. And thank you. Like, just thank you for meeting you and just getting all that knowledge. It was amazing. Yeah. Totally awesome.
And I gave you that little bug about geocaching too. So I accomplished something too.
Yes.
So once again, Rory, really appreciate coming on board. It's been a lot of fun. And hopefully, you know, next time I come over in the island, we'll go grab a coffee or beer and continue the conversation.
I look forward to that. For sure.
Awesome. Beautiful. Thanks again, everybody. Really appreciate it.